Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. Today's guest is Mark Lonow. Mark is the world-famous co-owner of The Improv. He is also an actor, a writer, director, and producer. But for me, he stands out as the architect of the modern-day comedy clubs. People like Mark, his partner, Bud Freeman, and Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store, belong on the Mount Rushmore of comedy. Mark is also the founder of the historical improv comedy group Off the Wall. This interview was thoroughly satisfying. I got to talk about one of my favorite subjects, stand-up comedy, with one of the architects that created it as we know today. During the interview, his wife even chimed in the background, giving him syrus, kvetching at him. It was just two old Jews talking, and I enjoyed it. Here is Mark Lonow.
All right. I'm here with Mark Lonow, and I'm so excited to talk to you today. Just before this, I was taking a shower, and I thought of something. I was like, that's how I want to start. So what I want to do is, this will be a mixture of kind of like a script, you know, and then just conversation, and then I'll lead you into a question. Okay, ready? Here we go. All right. So you're not ready. You're ready. Okay, here we go. Circa early 1980s. Los Angeles, California, Melrose. We land on the front of the Improvisation nightclub. Camera cranes down onto a convertible 450 SL. A beautiful blonde with feathered hair and white laced-up pants, remember those, gets out of the car with an attractive actor type. We follow them into the nightclub. People are eating dinner. We go through the hallway. Comedians are waiting to get on stage. We land on stage. A famous comedian is mid-set. Laughter off the charts. Camera pans over to a late 30s, Mark Lonow. A perfect combination of actor, intense entrepreneur with a 40-yard stare. The laughter fades to silence. Cut to circa early 1950s, Brooklyn, New York. A young Mark Lonow running through the streets. Mark, let me ask you a question. I ask this to everybody. When you were young, what was one of your major wants?
My major want at that point was
be an actor.
That was it.
And who was your influence?
I was studying at HB Studio. I started when I was 11. And I continued at HB for probably 8 or 9 years into my almost to my early 20s. And then I moved into improv. Moved into improv with a group called Off the Wall with my wife, later my wife. And at one point, Henry Winkler was in the group. And we became a threesome with a guy named Jeff Lampert. And began working the clubs, the improv. But we organized the Riviera Coffee House Cafe on 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. Joanne, my wife, and I walked by one day, and we noticed there were windows facing 7th Avenue, and behind the windows were just boxes. So jokingly, I said, you know, we could make that into a theater. Why would they have boxes in a room that overlooks 7th Avenue? We walked inside. The manager was Andy Menschel. And I said, Andy, what's in the back room? He said, boxes. I said, well, I'm so glad you're aware of what your businesses have. But let us put our improv group back there. And he says, you want me to pay you? No, we'll bring the audience. We'll talk about pay if this works out, blah, blah, blah. We opened up and we ran for about a year and a half when we moved up to the improv on 44th Street.
The famous Off the Wall improv group. Who did you start that with?
Well, with Joanne Astro, Henry Winkler, Kay Friedman. Am I going to remember everybody? There were a lot of people. Right. A lot of people. Actually, we were a big group and we were lazy, so we never really wanted to replace people. And so after Henry went to California long before the Fonz. We didn't replace him. You know, everybody kept leaving, and we wound up with three. We wound up opening for Maynard Ferguson, Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. We worked the bottom line, Grandma Minnie's in Philadelphia, all up and down the East Coast. So we were an improv group. And then eventually, it's long and complicated. I'm actually writing a memoir of this time. So,
well, there's a lot of things you could segue into, you know, as far as this time into so much more. Where would the next era, because you have a majorly long career, where would you next segue from this era to the next era? Where would that go?
Well, from there, we went, actually, our friend, Madeline Kahn, was doing Young Frankenstein. And before she left, she said, you know, I'm going to be in California. You guys want to take a vacation? Come out and visit me. I'm alone. You know, we'll hang out, blah, blah, blah. So Joanne and I went to our agent at that point, Michael Thomas, and we said, look, we're going to go to New York. We're going to go to Los Angeles. He said, oh, I have an agent out there. And you want to meet him? Yeah, sure. I go in, we fly out, we go in, I meet him. His name is Mike Rosen. It was Dade Rosen was the name of the agency. And he says, you want to go out on an audition? Oh, okay. I go out, I have an audition for a thing called Spencer's Pilot. And I was very, very nervous. I had been in show business from 11, but I had never been in front of cameras. It was always live. So there was prep and everything. Here I walk into an office. I'm seriously nervous. Right. I do the audition. And during the audition, I have to pick up a pencil and make a note. And I had glasses. I pick up the pencil. I go to take my glasses off. And the pencil literally goes up my nose. This is an audition.
Yeah.
Very first. And, oh, we all laugh. Ha, 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 ha. Thank you very much. I go back. My wife is in we were staying in my aunt's house because we had no money. And I break down. I go, I can't do this. How long have I been doing this? I was so anxious at an audition. I have to quit. I can't do this anymore. It's just too painful. And as I'm saying that, my hand to God, this is the truth. The phone rings. It's Mike Rosen. He said, you got the show.
Awesome.
I went, what? And I did Spencer's Pilot, which didn't go anywhere. But he then started sending me out, and I have lots of stories about
auditions. What year was that? That was 74 or 73?
That was 77.
77. This was right before Thank God It's Friday.
It was it was the first thing I did in Hollywood. I then got Thank God It's Friday. I then got Husbands, Wives, and Lovers, which is another very interesting story.
Real quick, Thank God It's Friday. You look like you had a great time on it.
It was a great shoot. It was in a place which was closing called Osco's Disco.
Yes, right there on La Cienega.
Right. It was this discotheque, and we partied. It was really a great time. And, you know, Lionel Richie, it was Donna Summer, and it was the Commodores. It was a big 70s rock and roll musical.
Produced by Neil Bogart. What was it like working with Neil Bogart?
Yeah. Well, Neil was a sweetheart. Yeah. And then he got sick. But yeah, Neil. And then later on, I played Santa Claus at the Los Angeles Children's Hospital for his wife, Joyce.
Nice.
Which is another funny story. I have a lot of funny stories. But yeah, here's the story of my getting Husbands, Wives, and Lovers.
Yeah.
I waited tables with Garland Jeffries. He's a kind of a singer, very popular in Japan, which is funny. And a director named Phil Messina. So the three of us, we kind of grew up together. We were in high school together. And we worked this nightclub, comedy club, Pips in Sheepshead Bay, which is a very famous club. And George always was next door in Joe's Clam Bar. So the three of us ran the place. And Rodney broke his act in there. Joan Rivers broke her act in there. So we got to know all of these people. The first big series audition I go to, not Spencer's pilot, that was, I was just going to be recurring, wasn't going to be a regular, you know, was for Husbands, Wives, and Lovers, created by Joan Rivers and Hal Dresner. I'm sitting in the lobby, and I don't know it's for Joan. It's just an audition. Okay. I'm sitting in the lobby, and in walks Joan through the door. And she passes by. I don't say anything. I'm playing it very straight. She passes by me, comes back, and says, "Mark? Hi, Joan. How you doing? What are you doing here?" "Oh, I'm auditioning. For the Husbands, Wives, and Lovers?" "Oh, okay." And she goes away. And she comes back. "You're an actor?" "Well," I said, "yeah, that's why I'm auditioning." She goes away. She comes back. "Are you good?" I say, "Well, yeah, I think so." "Okay." And she goes away. Now, they call people. They call me in. I do the scene. Not a laugh. My stomach is going, "Oh, fuck this. This is nuts." Okay. She said, "Would you do the second scene, please?" "Oh, yeah." Okay. So I do the second scene. "Thank you very much." I go, "Okay, yeah, thank you very much. That's it." I walk out. I walk all the way down the hall. And just as I get to the exit door of the lobby, the door to Joan's office opens up. She sticks her head out and yells down the hall, "You got the show, Mark." Closes the door. Nice. And that's how I got Husbands, Wives, and Lovers.
Is this right before, though, Thank God It's Friday came out? Because if anybody saw your role, yeah, They'd see you have the chops.
Yeah, that was before everything, because it was all mixed up. We did the pilot for Husbands, Wives, and Lovers, and then I got Thank God It's Friday. Husbands, Wives, and Lovers did not get picked up immediately. I and Joanne moved back to New York, and at some point, 3 months later, Husbands, Wives, and Lovers gets picked up, and now I have a series and a starring role in a big feature, and we moved back to Los Angeles, and we never left.
Yeah, late 70s, fun time for you.
Yeah. Well, it went all the way into the 80s. It was very nice.
Sure. Well, that's like another era, though, in the early 80s, though.
Another reality, yes.
Well, let's segue into that real quick. You like my comedy vernacular? Okay, so we'll go into that. So
I like the word segue.
Yeah, you've heard it a million times.
It's a little scooter, the segue.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about the improv. How did you get involved with that? I know, but just tell everybody.
It's all so incestuous. Okay, so we're running off the wall at the Riviera, and we are a hit. Let me explain to you how we open the show. We're on 7th Avenue, those sliding glass windows. So what we would do is we would leave the windows open, and the group, at one point we had 7 people, so the whole group would go across 7th Avenue, other side of the street, traffic going by, everything, right? And we would begin singing a cappella, "New York, New York," dodging through moving traffic. We're coming through the traffic across 7th Avenue, climb over the fence. There was a little like fence and like an outdoor cafe in front of the Riviera. Climb over the fence, singing. We climb through the window and into the showroom. And the showroom was then set up with tables and chairs, a little cabaret kind of thing. Everybody is shocked. We got nice reviews too, by the way. And we do the show. And we hired a cab to pull up at a certain time outside. So outside the window at this point, the cab would pull up. The cab driver would beep his horn. Whatever we were doing at that moment on stage, we'd go, "Oh, excuse me. We have another show uptown, but we're so glad we could entertain you." The crew would go out, climb back out the window, get into the cab, and the cab would drive away.
Very unconventional. Who thought of that?
Very unconventional. So anyway.
Who thought of that?
I did.
You did. That's awesome. That's awesome. Because that adds a whole dimension to a show.
Yes, it was a whole. Anyway, Chris Albrecht, who is managing the Improv Uptown on 44th and 9th, hears about us because now the word is around New York, blah, 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 blah. And he sends word down, would you like to work the Improv on 44th Street? You're an improv group. You know, and by then we had condensing here. By then we had whittled down and we were only three people at that point because we were at the Riviera for a while. And there are funny stories where Andy Kaufman came in to audition as our opening act. And now I have to turn Andy Kaufman down. Anyway, so we go up and we kill at the Improv on 44th Street. And he says, look, guys, if you want to come up here and be a regular, do. So now we have to decide whether we're going to stay at the Riviera. And for a little while, we did both rooms. But basically, we then dropped the Riviera and moved up to 44th and 9th. And I became friends with Chris Albrecht. Fast forward, Bud gets divorced. Bud has opened the L.A. club.
Bud Friedman.
And in the divorce settlement, his wife, Silva, his ex-wife, Silva, gets the New York club. And Silva, Bud, let's put it politely, isn't the best of businessmen. Silva is even worse. She goes to New York and Chris cannot deal with her. And he walks out. He quits. And I get a call. Mark, Bud is not doing well. I can't deal with Silva. How about you and me buying him out? And so the process of my becoming owner of the Improv began. But it was with Chris Albrecht, myself, and a third man, Steve Ziplo. And then the negotiation went on forever. Forever.
Right.
But eventually I wound up, the end of it is a little intricate, but the end I bought into the club.
Okay. So, but real quick, let's talk about one thing here, just a little interlude. I've worked with you. You don't remember, but I worked with you briefly, in 1990. I was a nightclub promoter. You have an entrepreneurial mindset. I've seen it. I've grown up around entrepreneurs and actors, and you have a combination of both. Where does that come from? Your entrepreneurial background and expertise?
I have not a clue.
What'd your parents do? What did your parents do?
I come from a very dysfunctional family. My father deserted my mother when I was 2 and my brother was 6.
Likewise, but my dad deserted when I was like 8. Perfect.
Okay. So my mom became very sick with colitis. And in those years, would kill you. And she wound up in and out of hospitals for the next probably 9 years. She didn't come out of the hospital on any kind of permanent level until I was 11. But she didn't talk to her parents. The only people who could take care of us were my father's parents. So my brother and I, and my mother intermittently, when she was out of the hospital, moved into my father's parents' house, the man who left us. And I didn't see my father. I saw him once when I was like maybe 8 or 9, and then he came back when I was 11 and my mom was out of the hospital. We got into a fist fight and I didn't see him again for another like 7 or 8 years, but then we moved out. But so that's, how did I get into this?
Well, I was asking, first of all, that's a New York story. It's so weird. You know what? There's so many parallels, not to be, narcissistic about it. But there's so many parallels between you and me. My dad was a homeless kid. He was put in an orphanage. And then he had to sleep on his grandmother's couch for several years. He started a company when he was 13 years old in Brooklyn, Sheepshead Bay, right where you are. Not only that, but my first nightclub was named Off the Wall because I was a big fan of the Off the Wall Improv Club. We can get into that later.
Wow.
Yeah. But we're also Ashkenazi Jews. How do I know that? Because I know another one when I see one. This is sick. This is crazy how many parallels. Yeah, we look the same. So here's the other thing. With the original question was, though, to go back to where we're at in your story, is that where does this, you have you're a workaholic or you're just intense. You got that 40-hour stare of an entrepreneur. Where does that come from?
I think that's instinctive, intuitive, genetic. Here's the thing. The one thing I do is continue with things sometimes way too long. And the ideas come constantly. And very often I will play with them, but if I really feel that they're functional, I will follow them. And so, you know, going into business, opening more nightclubs, doing all that stuff, it just happens. And I do it. Like this pandemic came and I'm shut down. So it took about 6 weeks, I don't know, maybe 2 months. And I started to write a novel. I'm on page 450 now.
Man, you got a hell of a work ethic. I've seen it. You know, that's what it is also.
Yes.
You got a little bit of a little hyperness in you. You got to keep moving like a shark.
Yes. That's my grandparents.
Okay.
My father.
There we go. It's got to come from somewhere. You know, a little bit of hereditary and you've seen it, you know, in some way, shape or form. All right. So let's go back. You buy a part of the improv. And then was that in New York and LA or?
There was just L.A. because New York was given to Silver in the divorce. So we don't have New York. Very quickly, though, she runs New York down. She has to give up the location. The club closes. Then she reopened on 34th Street in the back of a restaurant. I think it was a fish restaurant on 34th. That didn't run long. And then it closed. And then we had everything.
Yeah.
But we didn't have another club. We just had the rights to New York. It reverted to us. And we only had Los Angeles. Then a man named Mark Anderson, who was a comic and the therapist, asked if he could open a club in Pacific Beach and call it the Improv. So I spoke to Bud. We kind of negotiated a kind of a licensing fee. At that time, we called it a franchise. Then we got into the legalities of franchise versus licensing. So we then began to license. And as the time went on, we started to license. And certainly after in the early 80s, when we got Evening at the Improv on TV, then the licenses started to flow. And we wound up in the end, it went up. We went from 0 to 17. There was a little contraction. We went from 17 to 11. Then we went back up, and when I finally sold, we had 26. We had 26 nightclubs.
Okay.
License. We didn't run them.
So what year did you really get kicked off the improv in LA for you? What year was that?
8 years ago.
What's that? No, what year? Do you remember?
That we kicked off?
What year did you start the improv in LA?
Oh, I didn't start that. That Bud started.
What year did you start?
1973.
Okay, that's when it started. When did you start?
In New York, it started in 1963.
Uh-huh.
In LA, it started in 73, I believe. And I became a partner in September. It was a little later than that, but the letter of inducement is dated September of 1979.
Got it.
But I believe that I actually, the paperwork and everything, it was either late. I don't know if I made New Year's Eve 80, but it was around there, 80, the end of 79, the beginning of 80, something like that.
Right. At the incipient stages of the comedy boom.
No, it was 2 or 3 years because the comedy boom was instigated by an evening at the Improv. And that did not take full form until, I believe, 82.
Okay.
End of 81, 82. You know, my dates might be a little wrong.
Well, I think that as far as IMDb, it started in 81. You probably started shooting it in 80.
Yeah. No, we didn't. We did 52 initial shows. Okay, with 81, you're probably with 80. That's probably right. I directed, initially we had sketch comics that ran the club that were doormen, bartenders, and we did little sketches in between the stand-up act. I directed those, and we did 52 with a Canadian company, but we didn't get picked up. We weren't on A&E. Then we shut down for, I believe, 2 years. And in 83, we opened again and then ran for whatever it was, 11 years. Without the sketch comedy, it was just stand-up.
The dynamic of the improv, a restaurant on Melrose, you know, that artsy, you know, street in there, and the time, and, you know, people congregating there in the beginning of the night. First of all, from a business standpoint, you get them early to do dinner. They're drinking early from like 8 p.m. to all the way to 2 p.m. You're maximizing your amount of hours of alcohol consumption. And I'm sure that, you know, everything else.
Yeah. Okay, the improv in New York, which is the original concept, started as a coffee house. It didn't serve liquor. And Bud would literally buy the food that you needed to serve with in Smiler's, which is like a 7-Eleven, which is across 9th Avenue. And he would bring cakes in little, you know, noshes. And they opened at like 10 o'clock. It wasn't a regular. And the reason it's called the improv is that Silver, who was a Broadway dancer, said to Bud, look, we want to get married, but you have to have something to make a living with. Let's open a nightclub, a coffee house, not a nightclub. And I'll bring all my friends from Broadway and they'll entertain for nothing. People will come, we'll sell them coffee and cake and blah, 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 blah. And really, that's how it started. So it started as a coffee house. But there were, you know, Liza Minnelli was one of her friends. Bette Midler was a waitress. So it really snowballed and became this thing. And then he got a liquor license and it grew that way. And it did not start with comics. It was almost strictly singers because it was Broadway singers and dancers who had wanted to break in an act or whatever. And then a comic shows up. I never remember the first comic. We'll call it Robert Klein, but it wasn't Robert Klein. Right. But Robert Klein was one of the first because he was doing the Apple Tree on Broadway. And so this guy shows up. He says, can I go on? And Bud, one of Bud's great talents is that he never said no to anybody. He would let them go on. He would then see the act or whatever it was. The guy goes on, and he does very well. But at that time, there were no clubs where you could do stand-up. A million clubs where you could sing. No real stand-up clubs. There were places where an act would be hired, but no place you could break in. Okay, the very next day, he comes to open the club. He comes around, 4 or 5 o'clock, because they didn't really open until 9, 10. So, he goes to, and there's a line of people, men at that point, outside. What? Excuse me, why are you here? Well, our friend, and I don't remember the guy's name, said that you let comics go on. And they were all comics. Wow. Okay. So he now organizes it. So he makes a list, but he really, his business was based on singers. So it really wound up to be singer, 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 comic, singer, 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 comic. More and more comics came. Then it became singer, singer, comic, singer, singer, comic. Then it became singer, comic. Singer, comic, then it became comic, comic, singer, right, comic. Right. And it stayed, and that's why the piano is on the stage. And it stayed with singers pretty much all the way into Los Angeles. And Bud always wanted to be in California, so he went to California. And Chris was a double act with a guy named Bob Zmuda. Yeah. And he said, do you want to manage the club? And so Chris became his partner in New York.
So many giants, Zmuda, from Comic Relief and all that, and many other best friends with Andy Kaufman. So when would you say the improv for your time was at its zenith?
Oh, the 80s. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
We did. We went from one show a night. We always were 7 nights a week. We never closed. We went from one show a night, 7 nights a week, to three shows a night, 7 nights a week, week in and week out, week in and week out. And for about 3 or 4 years, came 11 o'clock, we would pick up the tables in the restaurant part, which is separated from the back, the showroom, and we had dancing. We had tapes, and Loretta, the bartender, would put on tapes, fantastic tapes that she created. And we had dancing until we closed, 2 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes we had 300 people dancing. Now, they weren't all in the room, but we had an upstairs, and, you know, so they would be hanging out at the bar, they would be dancing, they would be upstairs, they'd be on the street because we had the sliding doors. That's something, one of the things I did. I put skylights in. It was very dark, you know, the room was very dark. It was another nightclub prior to us, very dark. And I said, this, we can't do this. It has to be open. So we put the sliding glass doors in the front, walls actually, across the front. And we put skylights in, and the room became bright. I used to hand out candy. Were you there when I handed out candy kisses?
I don't remember that. I just remember, like, in 1984, it was like a combination of Studio 54 and a comedy club. And that was a place to go. And if you were going to go to a nightclub afterwards to go dance, you would go to the Improv first and hang out and have dinner. And then you come back later on to watch a show maybe at like 1 o'clock in the morning.
That is correct. Yes, And we used to throw one of the best Hollywood parties. Christmas time, we literally had an open bar Christmas night. Anybody who wanted to come in could come in.
Yeah, I snuck in. I was 17 in 84, by the way, but I'd get in there. So I was young. But I could go on so many great, you know, moments and so many dynamics. When there was like the inciting incident, though, let's talk about that from Scripps terms. What was like a moment? Do you remember a moment where it's really taking off and you're like, holy shit, this is big. This is getting bigger and bigger. Was there a particular moment where you remember where you're like just wowed?
Yes. Here's my wife. My wife, it's really crazy. We're doing the three shows a night, and it's Saturday night. We have 275 people in the showroom. We have sold 275 people for the second show. They are lined up in the street. It's not yet dance time. That comes at the third show. And I am now changing houses. 275 are coming out. 275 are coming in. I am the only person in the middle of the room, directing traffic, getting everybody so they don't bloody each other. And she comes over to me and she says, excuse me, Mark, we really have to have a conversation. I go, a conversation about what? About our relationship. About our relationship? Are you fucking with me? Do you see what's going on here? No, I can't do that. Look at this. Look at this. Later.
Yeah.
And she wanders away, and I realize never to be seen again.
Is she there? She's going to correct you.
Yes, she's always here to correct me.
Sounds like my wife.
There you go.
Yes, but I'm leaving. Goodbye. Finally, after 52 years.
Awesome.
And you know, I've been waiting for that.
Behind every strong man.
That's right.
Tell how you were the leader of the strike.
Okay, goodbye. I love my wife reminding me how I lived my life. I love her.
It's awesome.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
Yes. Love you guys. Have fun.
Feel like I'm back in the casino. So, let's talk about your relationship with Bud. I would think inevitably there's hills and valleys. What's that? Well, we're on relationships. We're talking about relationships now. Let's segue into relationships.
You go. Go.
Well, you know, we're going to get the truth from your wife. She's going to come in here and said, I'll tell you. Okay. So, you know, they say relationships sink ships. But without getting too candid, you know, what were some of the dynamics, highs and lows that you had?
Well, no, we had a very competitive relationship, let's put it that way. And the competition actually added to the dynamism of the club. and be very volatile. We argued, fought, screamed at each other a lot. And the comics knew that. And a lot of them would tease us from the stage. So there were, you know, so there was, it was integrated into the club because it was a hangout. So the comics were friends. The comics hung out at the club. It wasn't simply you come in, you do your set, you go to another club. You come in, you do your set, you hang out at the bar, or you come in, you do your set, you go to another club, do a set, you come out and you hang out at the bar. That bar was one of the hottest bars in Los Angeles for a good 10 years, maybe longer.
Right.
This is literally factual. There was a review, I believe it was in the Hollywood Reporter, that said it was either in one of the lead lines or in the very beginning of the review, if you can't get laid at the Improv, you can't get laid. When it came out, we laughed our heads off.
Right.
Because what happened was, so I become a partner. And this is actually one of the times that set off the volatility of my relationship with Bud. I am a partner. I have been a movie star. I have had my own TV series, or not my own, but I was one of the leads in a TV series. I have done 20, 30 TV shows, whatever.
Right.
And I've been on the stage since I'm 11 years old. I've done hundreds of shows at stock, regional, Broadway. I've done it. A friend of his comes in. First day I'm at the club. First day. And, Jack, I don't even know what the guy's name was. Jack, I'd like you to meet my new manager. And I don't say anything. Hello? And I go, Bud, I'm not your manager. I'm your partner. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. You know, it's been my thing so long. No, I didn't. But it was what he really, in his head, I was his manager. And that really set off a series of reactions to Mr. Friedman that were not pleasant. And it would wane and it would come back. He'd get jealous. We'd argue. It would wane. So that was the volatility. But that night, a lot of the comics came in because they realized that I was, you know, and I had been performing with them in Off the Wall. So I was one of them, and yet now I'm an owner of the club. And I think it was Rick Overton. Maybe it was Richard Lewis. I don't remember. He goes, wow, this is like a party. And I go, yeah, it is like a party. Oh, great. Okay. I run outside. I run out to whatever store was open, and I bought a big bag of Hershey's chocolate kisses. I ran into the kitchen. I go, is there a tray? And they had a silver tray. I have no idea why they had a silver tray. We did not serve on silver. So I put the candy kisses in the tray and I begin handing them out like you're at a party at someone's house. And for the next 10 years, every night, I was the guy with the candy kisses. And it became a party.
Right.
And that really, it really said, you're welcome here. This is our house. And we had, you know, we had Passover dinners with the comics that we did the Afikoman. And, you know,
Where did you always hide the matzah? Where was the typical hiding place?
In different places. We had a fireplace. One year I hid it up in the fireplace. It was
Which comic usually found it?
We had an Asian chef who insisted he knew how to make matzah balls. So, you know, he's a chef. Okay, whatever. Well, he baked them. And I did. I walked into the kitchen and they were underneath the salamander. And I go, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm making the matzo. Okay. And okay.
What nationality was this chef?
He was an Asian. I think he was Chinese. Okay. Chinese. Yeah. He was Japanese. No, he wasn't Japanese. He was Chinese.
Right.
Anyway, they were like rubber. Oh. And you had comics. And I forgot the comic. Anyway, an older comic picks the ball up, one of the, and he throws it across the room. And we literally had a matzo ball fight in the dining room during Pesach.
Wow. Who was the comic that usually found the afikoman, that found the matzah?
You know, they were all different. One, Kevin Rooney once, and he negotiated a 10 o'clock spot on Saturday night. That's what he got for returning the afikoman.
Nice. See, that's what added the smells to that club, too. That club had a very particular smell from the food and the beer, the alcohol and everything. But as far as the atmosphere and that time and the dynamic and, you know, everything, you just think of like a hodgepodge of the Lakers, the Stars, the nightclubs, the comics, everything in the early, mid-80s, that whole time. It was just the funny dynamic with you and that whole situation is that you're married. And you seem like, you know, there's a lot of carnality going on in that club, you know, like, you know, before or after. You know.
Ooh, a multi-syllable.
Oh, thank you. Wow. I'm a wordsmith. So, but you're like, once again, you're like the entrepreneur, you're a married guy, you're not getting, you know, I was like that with the nightclubs. I never got involved with any, you know, I just wanted to like talk to people because I enjoyed people and I wanted to earn a living and enjoy the people. And that's what you did. But there was a lot of craziness going on there. Is there anything that you could share as far as that era and that time of craziness?
Well, we did party a lot. And since it's 30 years later, at 2 o'clock, the parties went on after we closed. But they were private, and they were in the back showroom where we could lock the front doors, all the lights went out, and it was just like our home. And we partied in the back, literally dancing. But it's a nightclub. You couldn't hear it. So no one even knew we were going on, what was going on back there. But it went on for quite a while. I mean, we did party. And, you know, my wife and I, we owned the house closest to the Hollywood sign for like 15 years. And we would throw parties Friday night once a year that went on for 24, sometimes 48 hours.
Oh, my God. That sounds awesome.
We had the Santa Monica Club. So it started at 8 o'clock on Friday, where we had friends who weren't in the business. They would come over, they'd have a drink, blah, 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 blah. But when the Melrose Club closed, then all the workers, busboys, you know, waiters, whoever, comics would come over. Santa Monica would close, but it would take them a while to get to, so they would be the next shift. And then guys who were doing clubs away from L.A. would come. And it went on constantly until Saturday. We served breakfast Saturday morning. People were just sleeping. And we had a balcony that went around the house. It was a two-story house. And the balcony overrode the pool. So you could dive off the balcony, second floor balcony, into the deep end of the pool. It was a great time. So yes, we did a lot of carnality. And it was a big house. A big house.
Yeah.
So Michael Rappaport, who is our godchild, who lived as my wife's first husband's son, who wanted to be in show business and wound up living with us through high school. He went to Fairfax High School.
That's nice. Yeah, I met Michael once.
Yes, nice. I met Michael
too. I'm sure. So, you know, the dynamic there, you know, I'll go into a personal story. 1986, go by the improv. You know, we have dinner. We go on, we see a great show, good comedians. Then there's always a surprise, right? Ladies and gentlemen, Robin Williams comes on, does 45 minutes of his set material. Then he does another 45 minutes of just getting, you know, impetus from the crowd. And it closes the night out at that place. I mean, what place now can you go eat dinner and see the level of comics? And then you go, you're like, the dynamics is just like, where does that happen now? Where would you say that happens now?
It doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is because we really created, even more than the store, we created a familial atmosphere. At one point, and I was serious, I wanted to put a steam room because guys would come off the road and they would come to the club before they went to the house. And sometimes they would be working at rooms in the general area of Los Angeles, and they'd come in later. And I said, we should have lockers with comic names. They should have robes. And it came because Rodney used to come in with his bathroom.
Yeah.
And I said, then we should have a steam room. and a shower upstairs, and they could shower and shave, and, you know, the women could just get dressed and then come out down for dinner. And Bud went crazy. Yeah, it was one of my ideas. We never did it because also there were all kind of health rules. I started to go into what would have to happen, and I went, well, this is not going to happen.
From a comic standpoint, though, you get your schvitz in your shower because they're already probably hungover from jumping in, and you get refreshed, and then you can have a more in-tune set.
That is correct. Yes.
But you were an innovator.
It was a hangout. It was a hangout. So the shows went on. You know, we had guys like Charlie Fleischer, whose act went on forever. So we would always give him the last spot. And then he ran, you know, past 2 o'clock, whatever. We would just stop serving liquor. So we never broke any laws. But, you know, you go, Charlie, you can't do 3 hours. You can't do that. Please, there are other. So we just had to give him the last spot. But when we had stars come in, that was always the rule. They bumped. You know, if Eddie Murphy came in, he went on stage.
Sure.
You know, if Richard Pryor came in, he went on stage. So anyway.
Right.
But everybody knew that. Those were the rules, and people just followed them.
When would you say that the improv started to kind of wane?
It kind of waned and boomed on and off for a while. But in the early 90s, it had a big down before it came back.
Yeah.
And it did come back.
What do you think attributed to that?
I don't know. I think that a lot of the people who came up with the idea to be a nightclub owner, a comedy nightclub owner, said, oh, you know, this is easy. I just need a stage, an area, a microphone, and a light. I don't need anything else. Right. And that proliferated. At one point, you know, we were the only comedy nightclub in the world for a while. That's prior to me. Yeah. You know, there was no comedy nightclub. There was Bud and there was Pips in Brooklyn, but that also wasn't a comedy nightclub. That was a folk room that really catered to comics. Okay. And then it exploded with the Evening at the Improv. Now, everybody who has a microphone and a light has a comedy club. So people would then go expecting a show that you would see on Evening at the Improv or some of the decent clubs that were, you know, that were beginning to open. There were people who opened clubs that knew how to run a club. Okay, but there were lots of them that didn't know how to run a club. So now you plunk down $15, $10, $20, whatever the going. And it was a terrible show. The drinks were watered down. The food sucked. The comics were mediocre. Well, it kind of snowballs. And then you go, well, I don't want to go to a comedy club. So that it began to fade. So as I said, we went up to 17 clubs, the first expansion. And then in the early 90s, it really wasn't the late 80s, in the early 90s, we contracted. We went down to 11. We closed 7 clubs or 8 clubs. Right. But then in the mid-90s, it started to go back because all of the chaff flew away.
Fringe spots.
Yeah, the business got rid of them, and people then wanted to go back to good comedy. And so we started to expand again. And when I sold, it was 26 clubs. We controlled 26. We had the licenses for 26 clubs.
Right. Let's real quick, let's talk about the dynamic between the Pepsi and the Coca-Cola relationship between the Comedy Store in LA. There was the Comedy Store and there was the Improv. Could you tell, just give a really Reader's Digest version of that relationship and a little bit about that?
Well, Missy got the club from Sammy Shore, her husband. And again, she got it in a divorce settlement. Okay. She was really a good operator. And the club was next to Ciro's. And she was the only game in town. There was the Ice House in Pasadena, but that's Pasadena. It's not Hollywood. She's on Sunset Boulevard. She's got a great location. And again, she really treats it well. She builds a real following. And then Bud decides to come out. Johnny Carson moved out earlier. And because Carson moved out, this comedy store was the only room in Hollywood, in Los Angeles. And he goes in to see, or his bookers go in to see comics. Well, every comic goes to the comedy store. The Improv is doing okay, but really the New York Club is keeping it afloat because Chris was a great operator and all the comics really worked for Chris. Newman over at Cash did a great job also. So, and there was always a camaraderie. When we worked, when Off the Wall worked as in the clubs, if Rick Newman needed a comic, he would call the Improv. Hey, guys, I'm running short on comics. Send someone over. You get in the cab, they pay the cab. You do your set at Catch. Same thing, the Improv would call Catch. So there was never a competition. It was never like, if you work the Improv, you can't work Catch, you know, work Catch. Never. But Mitzi was very, very jealous.
Right.
And for 3 years or 4 years or however many years she was running the club, when Carson was there and there was no Bud, she was queen of the roost. Now Bud shows up and she says, you can't work the Improv. So the competitiveness, so guys would come over, but they wouldn't allow their name to be put on the list. You couldn't talk about them going because she would cut them off from stage time. We never did that. And that went on for years and years until the strike. And I was one, Joanne was the president of the comics union for 1 year. But we helped, you know, we helped organize the strike and the picket line, and we got the comics. This is before I became a partner, way before I became a partner. I wasn't even thinking of becoming an owner of a nightclub when I helped organize the comic strike. Because she was doing great. She opened, she was in Vegas. She had three rooms. It wasn't yet the main room. The main room was added. It was the original room. It was the belly room. And
that the belly room was the main room up in the comedy store?
The main room is Ciro.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Ciro's, that came later.
Right.
Ciro's and the comedy store are in the same building. They split, they share a bar.
Yeah.
The bar for both rooms is in the comedy store half. And between the two buildings is a doorway.
Yeah.
And rumor has it, I don't know if this is true, but it's a great story, that Mitzi kept asking Ciro's to sell to her. He didn't want to. And one day, on a Friday night, she locked the door. And they couldn't serve drinks in Ciro's. And then he said, what are you doing? She said, sue me.
Right.
And then negotiated the purchase of it.
She was a tough cookie.
She was a tough cookie. She ran a great room. She did run a great room. But all that animosity really began with her.
Yeah. I've done a lot of nights up in that belly room. And to that club, there's a lot of dynamics to that location and everything unto itself. You know, it's totally different with the Improv because they didn't serve dinner at the comedy. Well, they did, but not like the Improv. It was a total...
No, we had a full restaurant.
Full, like, you know, great restaurant.
Yes. We did pretty
a lot of other dynamics too, but so when did you sell your share out of it?
Just 3 years ago.
Just 3 years ago, and
just about 3 years.
What can you tell us about that? What are some thoughts on that?
No, emotional. It was time. You know, it was. Yeah, well, it had Bud wanted to sell. It was one of those things between Bud and I wasn't crazy about selling. I was willing to sell. He sold for a price I didn't accept. We went into arguments about, I said, I'm not selling. He goes, well, what do you mean? I go, Bud, I am your partner. I am not your manager. Right. And you can't sell my share of the club. So I negotiated the final deal.
Yeah. and you got the price you want. Once again, you know, that's the entrepreneurial. You're great at that. You know, you just, you had a feel for that too. Now, what, now, since you've done that, what have you gotten into? Tired just thinking about it?
No, I'm just, actually, I got into this writing bit. You know, Joanne and I, it was Joanne's business, because she's also entrepreneurial, management. And we managed comics. She started, you know, Lewis Black. There's a whole list of them. So we did that. But we kind of gave up on that, too. And the writing is now where my head is at.
What about acting? Because, I mean, of course, you're an actor, you know, natural born actor, yeah. Comic actor. I mean, your comic timing's off the charts.
Yeah. I was going to do that. And then I went, do I want to have all that anxiety all the time? I now prefer the writing a little bit.
Yeah.
More. Right. And also, because of the pandemic, I haven't really, there is no going out. There is no talking to anybody about doing a show. I'm in partnership with Paul Miller, and we're pitching a show called Know Your Neighbor, in which we do stand-up in the courtyards of building complexes. And we integrate problems that the people have. We interview the tenants. We do the, and they stand or sit on their balconies as we perform in a courtyard. We, you know, we pick specific buildings, right, complexes, and we're in the middle of selling that.
That's awesome.
Right now. That's that. And then I'm doing the novel.
But you still, I'm sure, like Adam Sandler calls up again, because you were in The Wedding Singer, calls up. He just probably called you up and said, hey, I got a part for you. I want you to be in my movie. You know, is that what happened with that?
That's exactly how it
right.
happened. He called. He said, you want to be in a movie? I go, what movie? The Wedding Singer. Okay, what do? You're the father or the bride. Oh, okay. What do? Show up Monday.
That's it.
That
no sides.
That was my
nothing.
That was my.
How long did you look at the sides before you started shooting? You improvised it?
I got morning. I got them that morning. I walked in. I did it.
Yeah. And you were fantastic. I mean, your comedy timing, it was just off the charts. You were doing great. I mean, it was a funny scene. You end up punching him out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. It's when they get more complicated, then it's really work.
Right.
You know, everybody, oh, so it's acting. You get up, you stand in front of the camera, you say blah, 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 and then you go home. Not exactly.
Right.
So there is work involved. And there came a point at which I had to say, do I want to do this? Now, I think that if it was something that I was creating, that might be different. And it's funny because I'm writing this novel episodically. So it takes place, there's New York, there's Hollywood, there's management, there's New York, there's doing off the wall on the road, there's moving to Hollywood, there's doing management. So it's episodic. And the structure is that each is, they're smaller stories that explain or illustrate the storyline, always with a laugh, or sometimes it's dramatic. There is an ending. Then you move on and you move on, but there is a through line. So it's I call it a novel. It's a novel memoir, because it's everything that happens is factual, and not only factual, but accurate, except for the timeline, because I move things around so that the storyline has a real progression and a build. But everything happened. But in life, everything doesn't happen sequentially.
Right.
So I reorganized it so it's sequential. But otherwise, everything is real.
What, you have a name for that yet? You have a name swirling around that you want to call it?
It's called Wave Dodging.
Wave Dodging. Why is that?
Yes. Because it starts with a dream of me drowning in Coney Island. That's how it opens. Right. I obviously don't drown.
Yeah.
But I wake up from the dream, and then I go forward into life. And then it's all kinds of the things that happen to me.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. Let me close on something I've been thinking about. You know, in 1990, for my age bracket, I was probably, you know, the biggest nightclub promoter in LA at the time. And my friend says, hey, I want to do a party. The guy that used to work for me, you know, I got an opportunity to do something at the Santa Monica Improv, do like a LA Kings after party. You know, and I said, oh man, you know, I got to do that because I'm a, you know, big fan. I was, you know, I started doing stand up when I was 19. Now, before this, you know, I had an opportunity to get involved with the improv in one way, shape, or form. Because when I was a nightclub, this is like in 1989. A year before that, I've always wanted to get out of the being a nightclub promoter and get into filmmaking and acting and get into that. And I'm going to name drop, but get a broom out because I'm going to not name drop. I was, my girlfriend at the time, her dad was Peter Gruber, this girl, Elizabeth Gruber. I was in love with this girl. And they said, they sat me down, they liked me, and they said, Mike, what do you want to, you're not happy? What do you want to do? Tell us what you want. We want to help you. I said, well, you really can't help me. I want to be a comedian. And I said, well, we know Bud Freeman at the Improv. And I said, no, you don't understand. I got to earn that myself. I can't just do that. But inside, I also didn't want to ask for the favor, you know? So then a year later, my friend says, hey, I got an opportunity. I Mark Lano, you know, I was, oh man, yeah, let's do that. So then I was expecting, and this really helped me grow, you know, as an entrepreneur, as an, you know, how to look at the film industry, how to look at acting and comedy. We were sitting out there at the Santa Monica Improv, and I was like, oh, there he is, Mark Lano. Yeah, I watched the, you know, Evening at the Improv, you know, and I know the history there, and I'm all excited. And the guy that showed up wasn't this like actor, comedian, kind of, he was a business guy. You know, you're coaching us. Okay, what are you going to do here? And what do you want to do? And this was like, I'm like, this guy's all business. And I was like, ah, okay, this is how it's done. And that kind of changed me. And I just wanted to say, this is like, you're part of the Mount Rushmore of comedy. And I just so thrilled to interview you today. And I'm famished. I'm beklemmed. I'm filled with geschmack because I got to talk to you today about your whole story and a fascinating story it was.
Thank you for saying that. That's very nice. Thank you.
Well,
that's really incredible.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. And you know what? When you're done with that project, I would love you to come back on the show and talk about it.
You got it. It'll be another year at least. It's a long haul to write a novel.
Well, no problem. Wait.
I'm on page 450. I think it's going to wind up to be 600.
With your work ethic, it doesn't matter. You're just going to, it's going to get done sooner or later, you know, just like everything else.
It'll get done, but it'll schlep me. I won't schlep it. It'll schlep me to the end.
Nice. Thank you so much, Mark. A pleasure.
This was very nice. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right.
That was Mark Lanau, legendary comedy club owner, actor, director, writer, and entrepreneur. I'll close today's show on this. Andy Warhol once said, being good in business is the most fascinating form of art. Mark Lanau is great at both. Thank you, and I look forward to joining you all on the next episode. All right. If you want to find out more about our show, go to longshotleaders.com. If you want to be a part of something special and get your daily dose of inspiration, perspiration, exasperation, knowledge, and creativity, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we do, share our show with your family and your friends, and put some positivity out there in the world. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again on the next episode, I bid you adieu. Where did I get French from?